To be fair, that's already true, but, you know, like...
And that's what I'm saying. There's this reluctance to hold people to account, but it's going to be even more so because there's really going to be no chance anyone involved in anything during this...
I've never heard of anyone being held accountable for droning weddings in Pakistan or Indonesia. but, you know, like, look, that aside, here's the thing. So I have a couple of really short philosophical thoughts on this. The first philosophical thought is that it undermines the whole concept of pardoning people preemptively undermines the integrity of the entire the process of, say, the January 6th investigations against Trump. The whole concept is that Trump did something really, really, really bad, and you're doing an impartial, nonpartisan investigation of him. If you're just pardoning everyone involved in that investigation, what does it say about the character of the investigation? It doesn't say good things. You know, like, it's, I can understand the reasoning, but it doesn't say good things.
Yep.
And I think it kind of reflects, in my view, a kind of, like, bunker mentality, right? It's kind of bunker mentality in the Democratic Party where they think, actually, everything's going to be rigged against them, and they issue these preemptive pardons. And the reality of having this bunker mentality of when you believe that everyone is, you know, being rigged against you, is that eventually there is no impartial system left if everyone believes this.
No.
But
it's also, you know, part of it is also that, you know, there, one thing, you know, there, the degree to which the American justice system and court system has been heavily politicized.
That's a lot.
Right? You know, and with, you know, the fact that, you know, journalists and others routinely talk about, without any sense of being a problem, the idea that there are democratic courts and there are republican courts and court systems, because the politically inspired
judges with little
R judges who've been appointed
by, you know, they call stuff like Obama judges, Trump judges. It's absolutely absurd. And I get it. Like, but I think the bigger question is, I think it comes back actually to January 6th, and it's not just the insurrection itself, which is absolutely horrendous and unconstitutional. But in my view, I think the subsequent strategy to deal with the fallout of that incident as well. And what I mean by that is the Democratic Party viewed January 6th as not just a tragedy for the nation and the Constitution, but a political opportunity. It saved them the necessity of making an economic or social a substantive case against Trump. It's just saying that he's an insurrectionist and there's no other argument. And
I don't know if I agree with that, because I think there's definitely a need to pursue a process to try and hold people to account, which has often been something missing in the American political system.
I agree.
So, you know, and you know, the fact that the Republicans refused to participate in that for entirely political reasons, you know, part of which was...
I think some Republicans did participate.
Well, yeah, and all those people got
expelled
punished,
right?
Yeah. I mean, the official Republican, you know, Republican Party officials in the Republican Party line was they were not going to participate, partly so that the refusal to their refusal to participate or the lack of participation could then be used as, well, it's not a fair and balanced process. But, you know, I think the fact that these pardons are even considered needed, you know, even in the divisive political climate, is also a product of how politicized the courts have become, and that, you know, and that, you know, even down to the, you know, everybody within the political system, not just courts and judges, but prosecutors and attorney generals, are all basically party political figures who, in many ways, have given up on their feeling that they need to operate even as politicians in a balanced and nonpartisan way. You know, I think in here in Canada, or, you know, in many countries in Europe, like the UK, you know, that system, and I'm not going to say it's a perfect system or, you know, not prone to any influence, but nobody is allowed or operates in a brazenly political partisan way within those contexts. And if they do, they get called out for it. And that, you know, and that does not seem to be the case in the United States anymore, where you know, you have politicized courts and politicized systems. And it seems perfectly all right for I think political leaders to try and manipulate that system, you know, to their advantage, and there seems to be no shame about it anymore.
I think the word you're looking for is called lawfare. Lawfare is this amalgamation of the word law and warfare.
Yeah.
And it's essentially using law to conduct warfare. And I think this is something that goes back quite a long time in the United States, because crucially, in my view, they have a system where everything has to be arbitrated in its final form by the Supreme Court, right? It's because in Canada, yes, we have a constitution, there is judicial review, but there's also a notwithstanding clause. At the end of the day, Parliament is to some extent sovereign. I think the fact that the Supreme Court of the United States is the final adjudicator of all matters between Congress and the presidency It makes it very tricky in the sense that everything becomes a judicial question in the end. And this automatically politicizes a lot of questions, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's unhealthy, but it's also, there's a lot of stuff which just simply should not be in the courts.
Agreed.
There are a lot of political questions which are political questions. They're not judicial questions. And
yeah, I mean, it does seem to be a thing that almost any sort of slightly, I'm not going to say controversial, but any sort of law that's passed.
Contentious issue.
Contentious, yes. That's the word I'm looking for. That gets passed, then gets challenged in the courts, right? And then sometimes held up, sometimes not. Usually those challenges don't go anywhere, but it creates a lot of sort of interference. And it's sort of, you know, except in you know, matters of rights and stuff, or to some extent adjudicating, you know, the division of powers between levels of government, you know, is it really right for the courts appointed, you know, courts who ultimately are appointed to their positions, which doesn't mean that, you know, to be always like overlooking everything the legislative body does.
I think it goes back to the 18th century character of the American Constitution, right? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the whole idea of the original Constitution is that the president is supposed to be an elected king constrained by an elected Congress, the legislature, and to some extent by the judiciary. And I think the way democracy has evolved in the Western world over the past two centuries is actually via parliamentary supremacy. And it's what in sort of political science called a fusionist network concept. And it's about the parliament being sovereign. And I think these different concepts, you know, like I think the American constitutional system is manifestly ill-suited for the 21st century for that reason. And I think that's kind of the problem here, because you look at something like environmental review in California, that goes to the courts. Yeah. You go to something like a zoning dispute, a school dispute, any kind of dispute goes to the courts. And these are political questions.
Yeah.
And, you know, how much tax should a California ratepayer pay? That's a political question. It's not a legal question. And I think everything being tied up in legal questions means that ultimately politicians become judges and judges become politicians. And the distinction between the two gets erased. Yeah. And I think the stuff like, you know, attorney generals being elected, state level judges being elected, that's kind of the surface level ephemera of a politicized judiciary. But I think the deeper question is just so many political and contentious questions being thrown to the courts, where it's just not, you know, how are judges the best suited to litigate some economic questions, for example, right? It's just not.
All right, well, we'll finish up with that. My last thought is that, you know, one thing I think about the United States, and it's what you alluded to, is that, you know, they were the first democracy. And they set up a system that was pretty good.
Yeah.
And then I think ever since then, you know, American exceptionalism and the fact that they're...
It's Windows 95. It's a great system. And then it's never been updated.
Exactly. And they refuse to sort of look at, I think, between American exceptionalism and also being the biggest, most powerful country tends to make them not look outside themselves to
not
see how others are doing things and whether there's some improvements they could make, which it seems
I just want to add one sentence,
needed.
Which is that in the post-war period, when America came up with constitutions for Japan and Germany, no one ever suggested that they use the American system. They used the European parliamentary system.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Stephen.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to go with some bird note here. It's just a little palate cleanser for all this sort of gloomy political talk. And then we'll be back in a minute and a half.
This is Bird Note. Birds have to be smart to survive, but their minds often work a little differently than ours. A new study reveals that pigeon brains sometimes operate much like a computer's artificial intelligence. In the study, researchers had pigeons identify different types of shapes, pecking a button to give their answers. If they got it right, they received a treat. The pigeons' powerful desire for food helped them fix their mistakes over time. At the start of the experiment, they averaged just 55% correct, only a smidge better than a wild guess. But by the end, they were scoring 95%, an impressive result for a bird. The researchers think these pigeons aren't learning a general rule they can apply in other situations. In other words, the birds haven't learned their shapes like a human child might. They're just using trial and error so they can choose the response that gets them food in this one situation. That's surprisingly similar to how computers learn how to do a task using artificial intelligence. AI picks up skills without learning general rules. Instead, just recognizing patterns to predict an answer. Clearly, we still have a lot to learn from bird brains. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
All right. Next up from our reporter, Danny Nesveradani, here is a report on about Burnaby's Stony Creek and the effect of road salt on the salmon populations and the overall water health there. This is from Danny.
Recent preliminary findings from a Lower Mainland-based research project shows that road salt, used to defrost icy roads in the winter months, may be having negative impacts on local salmon populations. The Road Salt and Pacific Salmon Success Project is a research project that is investigating these potential negative effects. In collaboration with 13 stream stewardship groups, the University of British Columbia, Simon Fraser University, the British Columbia Institute of Technology, and Fisheries and Oceans Canada, this project was originally spearheaded by the Stony Creek Environment Committee in Burnaby, BC. CJSF was able to get in contact with John Templeton, president of the Stony Creek Environment Committee, a volunteer organization dedicated to preserving and enhancing Burnaby's urban forest and salmon-bearing stream through various stream-keeping activities. We met with Templeton at Tributary 3A of Stony Creek, where he told us his journey with Stony Creek began.
I've always had a total love for nature. It was my playground in the countryside. There weren't any shopping malls, there weren't any rec centers, so nature became something that became part of me. So when I got to the point in my life where I could give back, I started volunteering at Stony Creek and for 21 years.
During our time with Templeton, he took us for our own journey through Stony Creek, where he explained what originally spurred the road salt and salmon research project.
So how this salt project got going was, many years ago, one of our volunteers, Vladimir, who was a biologist from the Soviet Union, we had checked the water quality, saw that there was an unusually high concentration of salt. So that spooked Vladimir's interest. Was it harmful to the salmon eggs that were spawned in the fall? So we got a project going where they took salmon eggs and they put them into Tributary 3A, which flows into Stony Creek. We also put them into another creek where the water quality was very good. What we discovered through that project were three things. That in Tributary 3A, there was a higher mortality. More of the fertilized eggs died. So those eggs didn't develop. Of the fish that did develop, we noticed that there was a hemorrhaging on some of the eggs and the kidney area. And the other thing we noticed that there were deformities. Some of the preliminary results have shown that when the eggs are first deposited, if there's a pulse of salt comes down and that salt concentration is high, it will kill the eggs. They've also discovered that there will be mortalities and the eggs won't survive if there's continued salt pulses in high concentration. So we know that it's a harmful effect.
Afterwards, Templeton talked about the unique situation of Stony Creek due to its close proximity to Burnaby Mountain.
We know that this creek is continually contaminated because many years ago when SFU was built, they had a salt shed. And that salt shed was built, and unfortunately, like 60 years ago when SFU was built, they didn't think much about the salt permeating into the ground and contaminating the soil. So what we discovered when we would do our water samples, that there's a high concentration. Now normally you would expect that concentration to disappear once winter and salt use on roads is over. But what we actually noticed, as the water flow decreased when it was drier in the summer, the time you're hitting August and September, the concentrations are getting higher and higher. And that was because the ground was contaminated. So that's another long story and another long battle with SFU. But eventually we got them to relocate their old salt shed. But the ground there is still very contaminated. So we actually call Tributary 3A, we call it Salt Creek because of those concentrations that are continually coming down.
Despite the various issues that stem from road salt usage, the research project has also highlighted various alternatives that have shown to be less harmful for local salmon populations, from alternative defrosting solutions to just simply using less salt.
Yes, and in fact, what SFU did, they pioneered using beet juice, which is a sort of like a sugar kind of a beet that they come from Tabor in Alberta, and they would mix that with salt water, and that brine solution, when it's sprayed onto the road surface, what happens, it will enable the salt and brine to last longer than just pure salt put on the road surface. So it protects the road longer and causes the ice to melt, so that's a win.
While the Road Salt and Pacific Salmon Success Project is ongoing, John Temple and the Stony Creek Environment Committee will continue to care for and analyze their local streams, as well as the salmon populations that inhabit them. Once again, thank you so much for listening to this piece. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This segment would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
All right, we have another report from Danny about Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group's Radical Book Fair, which they held last week. Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group is an independent student organization up here at Simon Fraser University. And here is Danny's report.
The Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, or SFPIRG, is a student-led organization at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, that focuses on issues regarding social and environmental justice. SFPIRG also provides political education services, and on January 14th, 2025, the organization held a radical book fair titled Rebel Reads that included various titles all pertaining to SFPIRG's focuses of social and environmental justice. CJSF took a trip down to the fair to learn more about what it had to offer, and we were able to gain some insight from Noel, SF Perg's director of engagement.
The idea for this book fair actually came from one of our board members. Yeah, we wanted to kind of like bring some of the books that we had like kind of removed from circulation in our library just because they were like maybe a bit older or folks like weren't sort of checking them out or they weren't getting the love that they deserved. So we wanted to bring them out here today. And yeah, we've got a ton of titles. Honestly, we're really trying to get them off our hands. So we're selling them for like $3, but also it's pay as you can. So folks can kind of just like get at really good ideas, because I think it's also just really important, I think, given the kind of like moment that we're in, to be like reading material and literature that is like conscious, political, and sort of directing people toward radical and revolutionary change.
Afterwards, we further discussed how SF Perg curated this specific collection of books to include for the Radical Book Fair.
These books came from a while back. Like, we sort of removed them from circulation before I actually started working at the Perg. So like 2 years ago. And so it's kind of a hodgepodge. There's like a lot of different stuff here, but all sort of like things that had arrived in our library because folks had kind of named an interest in them originally. So things that student boards and folks on the board in the past had sort of identified as important to read or as relevant to the kind of political interests of people at the time.
Lastly, we asked what the SFU community response has been to this Radical Book Fair and if SF Perg has any other plans in the future for similar events.
We've had like lots of folks just like coming by and kikiing over the reads. And yeah, we would definitely love to do more stuff like this, especially because, again, like, it's just nice to have like radical literature be shared with folks so that people can be like elevating their consciousness on campus, bringing it to their classrooms, and, you know, elevating kind of the sort of politics of their discussion.
Once again, this has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Thank you so much for tuning in to this segment, which would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada. You can also listen to this piece on frequencynews.ca.
And thanks to Danny for those two reports. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Stay tuned right where you are for Democracy Now! Coming up in about 10 minutes. And or not even 10 minutes, 7 minutes. And I'm sure they'll have lots to talk about today's proceedings and events. But before we finish up, Peter.
Yeah, one thing that happened in 1930 is called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, because they were, one was a senator, and a representative, I guess that means the House of Representatives, yeah. Reed Smoot and Willis C. Hawley. And there was tariffs enacted in 1930 that was...
This was right at the beginning of the Depression.
Yes, and...
With the hope that, I guess, that it would protect American...
Famously mispronounced by Michelle Bachmann as Hoot Smalley. Well, sorry, I just couldn't resist. That was great.
Yeah. Anyway, so they... Actually, one thing I saw something last week. I got the Wikipedia thing here. But on a YouTube posting, they were saying that it was the Franklin Roosevelt administration had it repealed. But they said the effects of it lingered for decades.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And yeah, yes. Well, maybe you can add a bit since you know a bit about this, Stephen.
It's. I think in many ways the protectionist tendencies of the American government goes back even further, because the great protectionist election was 1896, where McKinley, at that time, was big business, was protectionist because it was about protecting domestic manufacturers. I think fast forward to the Great Depression, that was, yes, the original impetus to protect American industry against cheaper imports in this middle of economic catastrophe. And yes, in 1945, when they finally won the Second World War, part of the design was to create an open trading system, at least among the Western allies.
Mm-hmm.
But as you know, U.S. domestic law, you know, they just stay on the books forever and it never gets erased. You know, it's like the Cuban embargo. It's like the Jones Act. It just never gets erased. And so there are all these distortions, right? Like Jones Act is actually one of them in the sense that you couldn't, you have to have an all-American, you know, you get that. But so the point is, it stayed on forever, but I think for a very long time, you were able to find ways around it. And the ways around it were permissible as long as the U.S. government didn't crack down too hard. These were kind of workarounds that were legal, but the government could also crack down on them if they wished.
I think one of the other reasons they tend to linger a long time, too, is, of course, you know, often there are winners and losers when it comes to tariffs. And, for instance, a protected industry that is, you know, it
softwood lumber being a perfect example of this, by the way.
Yeah, but a protected industry wants to keep a tariff. You know, it may generally be a negative for trade, and it may perhaps increase prices for consumers, but that industry benefits by, you know, having a better business environment for their businesses. And they, of course, will use whatever political influence they have to try and protect those tariffs that protect them. And so that, you know, sometimes makes it hard to get rid of stuff.
There's actually, sometimes you have non-tariffs that have the role of tariffs. And there's a really insidious example of this, and that's actually airlines. So airlines, in order to have flights between two different countries, you need landing slots. So the U.S. government has actually denied landing slots to a lot of foreign airlines because it turns out post-COVID, U.S. airlines didn't want to have competition from abroad.
Right.
So all these flights that were formerly available between Asia and the United States are no longer there. They haven't been restored because they would claim that, you know, it's in violation of this or they're overflying Russia or whatever. And it's just, it's anti-competitive behavior at the end of the day. So tariffs and also more insidiously non-tariff measures that simulate the effect of tariffs can last for a very long time.
I'd like to add something.
Yeah, we got 2 minutes here, Peter.
So a few years ago, there was a shortage on baby formula.
Yeah.
And what I found out about it was that the company, the United States, who made baby formula, had got the FDA to ban all of the overseas baby formula over from Europe on the pretense that it was the labeling only. That's why the FDA said you could not bring the over from Europe based on the actual labeling. And that's how they created, in a sense, a tariff on baby formula, and a crisis happened when they couldn't be supplying it. It's subsided, but that's an example of placing a tariff in a tricky way.
It's also butter in Canada, right? Like, you know, you couldn't get decent butter in Canada for a while. Still can't, actually, because of the way the dairy kind of supply management works, and you can't import that basic butter. So it's there are a lot of measures like this, actually. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so next week I'm going to check up on about the labor situation in mainland China. I'm a bit intrigued what the truth of it is.
Yep.
Are you going to be here next week, Steve?
I'm not sure yet. I might be.
Because I'm going to, because there is that accusation. They say, well, they're doing it because of slave labor. But
that's good to look into it.
True.
It's good to look into it.
So I don't, but we don't have it here in Canada. So there's no excuse for this here.
All right. So we're almost done with the show. Thanks to Peter and Stephen for joining me here today for a good discussion about some of this morning's developments down in Washington and the implications of those developments. So no tariffs. No.
The most beautiful word in the English language.
It's a terrible word.
No tariffs at the moment, but
we will see.
But we have a whole load of preemptive pardons being issued and that has it, you know.
Has he signed a TikTok?
And of course, I guess one of the big things we're expecting from today is that Trump will pardon all the January 6th protests. He said he was going to do that on day one. We'll see. That's time for us. Democracy Now! Is up right now.
Hi, I'm